Monday, everyone. How's everyone doing on this hopefully lovely Sunday morning? This is your first time hearing this. This is a special episode that we decided to do in light of the assassination of Jovenel Moïse in Haiti. We were going to make it our Thursday night foreign policy show, but because we had some guests and we weren't sure if they were going to make it, they were kind of late in confirming before Moïse, of course, got assassinated, which was kind of surprising and a shock, right? We were very excited to do this episode on the situation in Ethiopia and Tigray. And there was a young woman that came on the show before. Her name is Khadija. She did a show about like racism and AI, and she's Ethiopian. And she didn't want to do the show, so she connected with some people. Anyway, we ended up doing the Ethiopia show. We didn't know if they were going to be able to stay, the guests. So we had planned to do the bonus hour about Haiti, and you know, the guests ended up staying. They were amazing guests, and stayed about an hour or so after hours. Great show, very informative. So we decided Friday we were going to do a special free stream. You know, sometimes we do these special streams. More often than not, they're patron only at this point. So we decided Friday we'll do another stream, and we'll invite back Professor Paul McComb, who was also of a Haitian descent like Pascal. And Pascal said before the show, he's like, look, if anyone knows more about Haiti, it's Dr. Paul McComb. And great discussion. Initially, both guys were kind of tired. Pascal had done the majority report earlier that day. He knew he had to get ready for the Saturday show. Then he had like two shows he was doing on Saturday. So he was like, let's kind of make this a little shorter. We don't need to do a bonus for this. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I agree. The same thing. I was on a time constraint as well. Dr. McComb was on a time constraint. So I said, you know, we'll go 45 minutes or so, 30, 45 minutes, and then we'll take questions. Well, those cats went like an hour before I had to like interrupt. Pascal was on the majority report with Sam Cedar earlier that day, giving a very thorough history lesson on Haiti. And when we were trying to figure out where to center this show, you're going to hear a video clip. And in the video clip, it starts with Papa Doc Duvalier, a clip of him. And then it ends with his son, baby Doc Duvalier, and when he was leaving the island and how people felt at that time. I was like, why don't we start it more contemporary with the Duvalier regime? And they were like, no, we can start like around World War One, like a little pre-World War One. That'll really give it really good context. And I was like, all right, that's where you guys want to start it. Remember, 45 minutes. But I think that context was needed. You know, even if we would have started it in the 60s, it still would. They would have had to gone back then. So it was a great show. Again, amazing Marxist analysis from those two. I just got to sit back and watch, and of course learn, like everybody else. So I decided, you know what? Let me drop this for the Sunday episode, the Haiti show. So this is our very own Pascal Robert and Dr. Paul McComb. I know it's probably kind of strange to get like back-to-back episodes with a guest, but we were able to get Dr. McComb to come out of the woodwork. You know, he doesn't do a lot of these shows. He actually turns a lot down, especially now. He's turning a lot down. So we're very, very honored, very, very thankful that he was able to join us. If you want to watch this stuff live, the best way to do it, subscribe. Excuse me. It doesn't cost you anything. It's free. YouTube.com/ThisIsRevolutionPodcast. If you have the means and you'd like to help the show grow, become a patron. We do some special bonus patron shows. We're starting our now Ask Pascal show, which is going to be a monthly show. We just started doing our monthly phone calls with people. That's been kind of cool. We're getting back into movie night. We have a show. We call it the Nerd Night Show, where we talk more so about pop culture and tie that in with politics. So maybe we have to find a different name for that. But we decided to Ask Pascal show. We're going to call the Mau Mau Hour with Pascal. I like that. Bajlan thought it up, and I'm like, you know, that works. I like that. It's a beautiful ring to it. And there's some other stuff in the works. We're going to be adding another day to the live streaming. So there's a lot going on. So subscribe, help the channel grow. Again, it doesn't cost you anything. Wherever you're listening to this show, there's links in the description to all of our social media so you can follow us. And on that note, here is our very own Pascal Robert and Dr. Paul McComb giving you a breakdown on the history of contemporary Haitian politics to frame accurately the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. Good evening for a special stream today on this lovely Friday evening here in Oakland, California. And for those in the chat wondering the music, yes, that is me. I play all the music that you hear on the show, even the chill stuff. I make it. I had to stop doing music when the pandemic happened. And this is the closest thing I have to touring, is doing these live shows with you guys and my best Haitian friend, who is joined by his best Haitian friend. It's just a bunch of best Haitian friends today. He blew up the majority report. He talked over Sam Cedar and Emma Vigeland a couple times. It was rather hilarious. I love him. I mean that with all sincerity. Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
And before we bring on our next guest, who also blew up the spot just a few days ago on our Tuesday show, let us play the Haiti intro video.
The beautiful, bedeviled land of voodoo, manacled to a rhythm of corrupt government and bloody revolution. Haiti, and in the heart of its capital, Port-au-Prince, the presidential palace. From this stately arsenal, an isolated, despairing nation's ruled by a man who is everywhere. No other land has such sickly impact. You see his iron grip in the guns of his chosen. You feel his menace in the pit of your stomach. You hear his presence in the silence of his subjects. Papa Doc, Dr. François Duvalier, spiritual leader and president for life. His years of absolute power have brought terror to his people, ruin to his country, and the inescapable threat, whoever destroys Duvalier, destroys Haiti.
With the recent assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse, Haiti is currently at a tipping point. On this episode, we will look at the who, what, where, and why to inquire as to what forces could have possibly been behind the assassination of Haiti's President Jovenel Moïse. This is Revolution.
Thousands of Haitians made a pilgrimage today to Gonaïves, a city north of Port-au-Prince, where three students were shot to death last November. They were remembered as martyrs at a mass celebrating the fall of Duvalier, which was also hastened by pressure from the Catholic Church. The church and the army are now the two strongest institutions in Haiti. So far, both support the new government. The government let three special flights land today at the Port-au-Prince airport. An Air France flight from Paris carried three army officers who had accompanied Duvalier last Friday. Protestant missionaries made up most of the passengers bound for the U.S.
Perhaps it's safe, perhaps it isn't. We don't know what the next few days might bring, so we feel like we should go out for a while.
But not everyone at the airport was leaving. Haitians are not yet allowed to leave. Some foreigners who can leave are choosing to stay.
We're going to stay. We're not going.
Do you think the change of government is going to help you do your missionary work?
I believe we're going to see a great change in Haiti.
But some things won't change soon, even with free elections. Pervasive poverty, widespread illiteracy, and a tragically high infant mortality rate can't be cured at the ballot box. Learning that may be Haiti's first lesson in democracy. Reporting from Port-au-Prince, Michael Putney, News 4.
All right, well, let's bring in our guest, special returning guest, Dr. Paul McComb. You guys are going to get into a conversation about contemporary Haiti. There's probably going to be questions flying on the chat. So these guys are going to talk for about 45 minutes, and then the last 15 minutes, we're going to take your questions.
And super chats.
The super chats definitely are open, and I'll let you brothers get to it. I'm very interested to be a participant as well in this conversation.
Well, all right, Brother Paul McComb. First of all, I say sac-passé to the Haitian community overall, to the Haitian diaspora in this time of crisis for the Republic of Haiti, the ancestral homeland of myself and Paul. Now, for those of you who watched the majority report earlier today, this afternoon, I did a kind of quick, deep dish dive into the history of Haiti from the Haitian Revolution up until modern times. I don't think for the sake of this podcast, due to the limited time, we're going to go through all that history. If you want that deep dish dive, go check out the Majority Report episode we did today. What Paul and I are going to do is we're going to cover Haitian history to the contemporary moment from the U.S. occupation of Haiti in 1915 up until the current crisis with Moïse, because there's a lot of parallels behind the realities that gave birth to the U.S. occupation in 1915 and the current situation. First, Paul, to give us context, because I know you are more well-versed on the history than I am, what were the phenomenon from the geostrategic to the political consequences in Haiti that manifested in causing the U.S. occupation of Haiti in 1915?
Well, a couple of things. To begin with, there is the assassination of the then president of Haiti, Vilbron Sam, who was assassinated.
What year?
1915. In fact, the U.S. would occupy the country the following day, July 28th, the following day of 1915, following his assassination. So what brings about, we have to understand the political economic position of Haiti at the time, which would bring about this occupation of Haiti. Number one, there is this dialectical struggle in Haiti since 1804, leading up to 1915, between two emerging ideologies that still dominate contemporary times. Protectionism, what was then called mercantilism back then, and free market capitalism, which Adam Smith would articulate in The Wealth of Nations. Today, you can juxtapose these two dialectical ideologies in the sense of neoliberalism on the one hand and protectionism or right-wing nationalism, reactionary nationalism on the other hand. And I think the best scholar who understood the dialectical struggle between those two elements of capitalism, they represent two sides of the same coin, is Karl Polanyi and his Great Transformation. Now,
can you explain to me, for in that time, how those two factions manifested? How did the mercantilism in Haiti in the early 20th century manifest? Yes. And how did the protectionism manifest? Who were on each side of that argument? Yes. Class, complexion, and otherwise.
Yes. So what we get, so leading up to 1915, you have two struggles in Haiti between the Black Creole, who represented the land owning class in Haiti, what they would call the Gondon class.
The Gondon class, by the way,
coming out of slavery.
My father's family comes from the Gondon class. These are Black Haitians who can trace their lineage to generals who fought in the Haitian Revolution.
In the Haitian Revolution.
Who are pretty much upper middle class and comfortable. They are Creole Blacks. They have servants. They have restaveks. They have property. They have land, but they're not mulattoes.
Yes. So their ideology is essentially a free market capitalist ideology. Why? Because coming out of the Haitian Revolution, Haiti was blockaded by the white power elites of the time, and they did not allow for trade between a group of Black generals or the Gondon class and the outside world. So the mulatto elites, basically coming out of slavery, they positioned themselves as basically in the export-import trade in Haiti. So they would serve as middlemen between the Gondon class selling their products out of the provinces and off of the land, sugar, whatever it may be, property-owning class and agribusinesses, and the outside world. So most of the wealth of the mulatto elites came from an export-import or control of the export-import trade.
Let's bring it up. Basically, what we're saying is that because the mulatto elite were more aesthetically in line with European and Western standards and were not basically Black, the white world was more willing to internationally interact with them to do trade than seeing Black generals who fought in the Haitian Revolution land up on the shores of South Carolina and said, let's do business.
So they essentially control the price of export goods and import goods. So whereas on the one hand, they wanted to protect the import-export trade, have a monopoly over that trade against the white world, the Gondon class, on the other hand, they preferred free market capitalism where they can freely trade whatever group they could, whatever group they wanted to trade with. So this struggle between what would be what are essentially two capitalist class would lead to political struggle over control of the Haitian state. And this is what would lead to the assassination of not only Dessalines, but also the assassination of Sam in 1915. So it is this struggle between these two groups have plagued Haiti from 1806, 1804, all the way up to contemporary times. It is control over the state and the apparatuses of the state, which has no authority over the masses of people. The state, because it lacks any form of revenue, any sort of way to tax the people, et cetera, basically have no authority over the people. There are only
When you say the people, you're talking about who?
The
grassroots.
Yes.
Or pejoratively called paisa, the peasant class, abita, the people out, you know, the voodoo sector, et cetera, which make up at least 70 to 75% of the Haitian population.
Yes. So the interests of these two groups converge, and their interest is twofold. One, displace the map for the Gondon class, displace the masses off of the land in order to acquire as many acreage for agribusiness as possible, and into the capital city where the mulatto elites and the Gondon class can use them as a lumpen proletariat, a reserve labor to work in factories, etc. So it's a
dialogue. Let's understand something. We're talking about a beef, an economic ideological beef between two bourgeois classes, a black bourgeois class and a mulatto bourgeois class, both fighting over how they basically can oppress 75% of the population who are directly descended from Africans. Correct or incorrect?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this struggle, now, the mulatto class would be, basically, they would, this struggle between these two classes to push the masses off of the land and into the cities to serve as a reserve labor force would be used by the Americans to basically, during this whole manifest destiny of the 19th and 20th century, America would use this to their advantage. They would attempt to infiltrate, like they did in Latin America, infiltrate Haiti, provide land for companies such as United Fruit Company, Reynolds Aluminum, for example, which was in the southern part of Haiti, and control that agribusiness that the Gondon class would have. So what you would find in reaction to the Americans attempting to gain control over the agribusiness in Haiti, the Gondon class would grow more nationalistic than your mulatto class. Not to say the mulatto class weren't nationalistic, but the Gondon class tended to be more nationalistic because they viewed the infiltration of outsiders into the politics of Haiti as attempting to undermine their sovereignty.
The sovereignty and also the racial legacy.
Yes, of this Aline. So this was a false sense of nationalism.
Because what happens is that the Grandon class has Dessalinean black nationalism, but not Dessalines' notions of democratizing the economy of the country.
Absolutely.
I would make the argument that the Gondon class is more the inheritor of only Christophe than Jean-Jacques Dessalines in some way.
No, I would support that argument. Absolutely. Now, what we find is there is this dialectical struggle over the state to maintain their economic position. The mulatto elites in control of the import-export trade and the Gondon class in control over the agribusiness coming out of the provinces of the country. So in attempting to do so, they displaced the majority of the people. Remember, following the assassination of Dessalines, the majority of the masses moved into the provinces and into the mountains away from any form or any affiliation with the corvée system that Dessalines and Toussaint and Christophe, to some extent, attempted to implement. So the whole emphasis of the majority of the masses was land ownership so that they can grow agricultural products via the Lacou system, which contradicted the attempt of the Gondon class to expand their land ownership for agribusiness purposes. So when
let me interject.
Go ahead.
The Gondon class, the Gondon are the black Creoles. In other words, black, like my father's family, who were born on the island, who had land inherited from the generals. Even back from the beginning, they basically wanted to maintain their agribusiness farmland as large-scale plantations with the peasant or voodoo sector working as almost like slave labor, and they're reaping the benefits and allowing mercantile capitalism to continue, while the mulatto elites wanted to take the profits and some of the merchandise that was being generated from the Gondo class and trade it internationally. And sometimes, obviously, because Haiti was under a blockade, they would be doing that under black market circumstances, but they would still want to be shipping and trading, and they became controllers of the export-import business, and that gave them access to a larger scale degree of wealth and economic opportunity. But the peasants wanted to implement the Laku system, which is a voodoo cultural-based communal farming system that's a farming cooperative, which allows them to cooperatively grow their crops together, pool their resources in their crops, go to market, and sell their crops in the commercial market in Haitian society and generate the profits and share them amongst themselves. Correct or incorrect?
Absolutely. And this mulatto class would also be supplemented by Germans, foreigners, Arabs, Syrians, who would also join them as part of this urban elite in control of the export trade following the American occupation. So what you find under the American occupation is this insistent push to get the peasants off of the land and into the capital city. So this incessant push from 1915 to today has led to the de-agriculturalization of the Haitian countryside. So as American companies started to obtain land from the Gondon class and remember, if you understand under the occupation, there's this alliance that would take place between the Gondon class as well as the peasants as they attempted to fight against the American takeover of the Haitian countryside.
That's correct. So you would find the black elite would side with the black peasants against the U.S. because they use their racial solidarity to see them as a threat to the, you know, that's where you get the Cacos Rebellion. You have a lot of black elites fighting in the Cacos Rebellion, which is a rebellion of Haitians against the U.S. occupation under the protection of the Haitian sovereignty. In reality, though, the Gondon class wanted to protect Haitian sovereignty in order to maintain the class hierarchy that was oppressing those same peasants they were using as military fodder.
And this is paradoxical because technically there's no difference between the ideology of the Americans as they came in to try to ascertain as much acreage of land as possible and the ideology of the Gondon class who wanted to do the same thing. They simply wanted to control agribusiness as opposed to white Americans controlling the agribusinesses. So same ideology, is just who's on top. So it's capitalism with a black face, essentially. But they use black nationalism to basically fight against the Americans as they attempted this occupation. So over time, what would happen in the Haitian context, as in all over, this is the direct parallel between what happened in England coming out of the 17th century, what happened in Latin America, is that you get the ever-increasing movement, this push and pull between the peasants moving to the cities looking for work, because as the people are displaced off of the land, there's no way to feed their families now. So now they have to go to the cities, to the capital cities, where they're looking for industrial work to supplement their income. So what you find from 1915 to contemporary times is this ever-increasing proletarianization of the Haitian peasantry into the capital city of Port-au-Prince. So whereas coming out of 1915, there's about 100,000 people in Port-au-Prince. Contemporarily, there's over 3 million people in a capital city that was only built for 50,000 people. because this push and pull off the land, and this is clear as we will see when we get to what would happen under Matali and contemporarily with Jovenel Moise. So it is this constant struggle as the peasant class moves into the urban centers. There's no jobs. There's no work. There's no means of making a living. You're no longer on the land where you grew your own crops and had your own home. Now you're in the capital city where you have to sell your labor power to obtain a means of making a living. So this played in the hands now of the mulatto class, who saw this as a means to basically supplement their income by allowing industrial work, assembly capitalism, factory capitalism into the Haitian state.
So by now, with the building that with international actors, yes, foreign power.
Yes. So now there's a shift. So now we're in the under the U.S. occupation, the Gondon class is fighting with the peasantry to prevent the Americans from overtaking the land in the provinces and in the mountains. In the cities, the mulatto elites would welcome this because this provided them a new source, a new income source by opening up the land, the urban centers to industrial production, cheap labor. And it is this push to turn Haiti into a cheap labor force in the Western Hemisphere that would give rise to the contemporary problems we're seeing in Haitian society today. As the mulatto elites now, their investments shift from export-import trade.
Now, but they're not mulattoes anymore. Now they're the oligarchs.
No, now they're an oligarch, absolutely. Because we see a transition. Whereas the mulatto elite, supplemented by Germans as well as Syrians and a group of Middle Eastern
who start coming into Haiti in the late 19th, early 20th century.
Yes,
and because even though they were poor when they came in, because they had international trade skills and connections, yes, and they were also white or fair complexion and appearance, could engage in international trade and begin to monopolize market share of the international trade. Starting with in the U.S. occupation, but particularly in the post-World War II era.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely. So what you have is this transition with the new emerging oligarchy who now shifts their investment from export-import trade. They still control this import-export trade, but now there's a new investment into opening up the Haitian market to assembly factories. And this becomes a cheap labor force for America because there's no need now to go to Vietnam, China, et cetera, whereas it's in your own backyard. It becomes cheaper as opposed to importing things from China and elsewhere. So now the struggle becomes having Haiti now transitioned into an industrial factory hub for the West versus the Gondon classes insistent on maintaining control over the agribusiness. So now the struggle becomes either opening up Haiti to investment from the international community so that they can for assembly factories versus the Gondon class now following post the American occupation, their focus is back to agricultural production for export. So it is this struggle, and those who control the state then controls the route that Haiti would take post-World War I, post-World War II. So from 1934 till the end of when the American occupation ends to contemporary times, it is this struggle between the urban elites attempting to open up Haiti to foreign investment in industrial production versus the black nationalist class. And of course, I'm trying to condense this so there's some intermixing, of course, who wants to maintain Haiti as an export agribusiness society, an agricultural society.
And well, I would argue, Paul, let me interject. I would argue that is the case through the 30s, 40s, and 50s, where the Gondon class, like my grandfather and my father's family, and others still owned land, still had people that could farm the land. They still had their habitation. Like my family had habitation Robert. Mm-hmm. Everyone, they had their plantations. But at a certain point, we find, right, and this happens after Duvalier, because what happens is that Duvalier causes the migration. Duvalier actually exacerbates this system by actually professionalizing the Gondon class and incorporating them into the petite bourgeoisie the professional state apparatus.
Absolutely.
So they start to buy into that.
Absolutely.
They start to buy into the industrialization paradigm as well.
And tourism comes to play a role as well.
And they start to buy the tourism. So what I'm saying is that the role of the Black Gondor descendants of the generals of the revolution in terms of wanting to maintain those habitations, those land, those large farms, starts to shrink eventually through the Duvalier regime. They still
Now, it would be wrong to just attribute it to Duvalier, because technically it's out of their hands. By the time Duvalier get into power, it's out of their hands. It's out of their control. They're being undermined by the urban elites at this time. So technically, whereas they want to hold on to this this aristocratic lifestyle, is more or less a feudal lifestyle. By 1950, it's out of their hand. The urban elites are in control with the aid of America. They're in control of the state, and every policy that's implemented is to undermine the Gondon class. It's to
right. And up until 1950, the urban elites generally were mulattoes, but because of, I believe it was Dumas Estime, he started to incorporate more Blacks into the urban elites government positions.
Absolutely. So by the time Duvalier comes into power, there's a professionalization of the Gondon class that is taking place. He would exacerbate what Estime starts. Duvalier would exacerbate this profession.
So what that basically means is that the Gondon class, who was a big plantation, a big landowning farmer who had a plantation, who was still an elite, now becomes professionalized as like head of this Haitian cement company or head of the Haitian accounting, state accounting firm. He gets some education or some vocational training, and he's running state apparatuses from Estime going on
to Duvalier.
And he also having his land squatted on by peasants.
By peasants.
And not paying attention to the land anymore.
Absolutely. So there's this. So what happens under Duvalier, there's also this push or this realization that the only means to economic gain, and this is the transition that would take place and dominate contemporary Haiti today, is the fact that the only means to ascertain economic growth or economic gain for the Black Gondon class was control over the state itself. So as middle managers for the elites, which is why, you know, since under Geoffroy, you would have this politique de doublé in Haiti.
The Gondon class
realized, okay, the masses will protest, but if we play on the nationalism of the masses, we can get our policies implemented. So long story short, so we get at this time, we're stuck in this struggle between this urbanization of Haiti by displacing the masses off of the land, who now must turn to the cities as a lumpen proletariat, looking for work in assembly factories and in the tourism industry as well. So the same thing that would happen in Jamaica in the 70s and 80s was happening in Haiti beginning in the 1950s going on up. And it is this struggle to either continue this policy where now the struggle for the Gondon class becomes, okay, you're trying to remove us off of the land. So the only opportunities we have now is in control over the state. So now the struggle becomes the mulatto elites who want this ever-increasing urbanization of Haiti and the Gondon class who want to participate it by serving as a professional managerial class in control over the state apparatus.
And what's even funny is that both of them as the increase in the economic strength of the foreign oligarchs, the Arabs, the Syrians, the Europeans, and the German descendants get stronger and stronger, they both lose their position as the top of the bourgeoisie and become subservient to the foreign oligarchs.
Yes, right?
What point in history do you see that really start happening?
I would say beginning in the 1970s, you start to really see that post, really under Jean-Claude, after the death of Papa Baby Doc and this, after the death of Papa Doc, you start, and here I must say, my father's cousin is Michel Binet. So I have to, as a disclosure, full disclosure, I am related to Michel Binet, who was
Michel Binet was the woman who was married to
Baby Doc. So Baby Doc really lost control, whereas Papa Doc attempted to professionalize the Gondon class. I believe Baby Doc basically sealed his faith when he went too deep with the manager. The oligarchy. He allowed them to implement as much, and plus the corruption was rampant. He lost control in the mulatto elites basically became an oligarchy controlling the policy of the Haitian state, essentially. And the Gondon class basically was in place to execute and exercise whatever the oligarchy desired.
What's fascinating, right, is that you know that the foreign oligarchs supported François Duvalier, the father.
They gave him
support because they realized he was going to neutralize their common enemy, which were the mulatto elites, who they hated the most.
And not only that, but remember, François Duvalier was an anti-communist. So
right.
And they viewed him, especially his push for the professionalization of the Gondon class, as a partnership, essentially. Because now what you had under Duvalier is the oligarchy was able to control this push towards the urbanization of Haiti, and now you had the descendants of the Gondon class as the professional managers
Duvalier is violently antagonizing the mulattoes.
Exactly. So now you start to see the rise of the Haitian oligarchy in control over not only the trade, but also the political apparatus through the professionalization of the black class, of the Gondon class that would take place under Duvalier. Many Haitians would go to school, study abroad, etc. So you see this marriage now, which is why you would see from under Papa Doc all the way to 1986 when Baby Doc leaves the country, there's this. You have factories have taken over all of Port-au-Prince. You see tourism all over Port-au-Prince. What's happening today in Jamaica, where people are vacationing in Ocho Rios, was happening in Haiti in the 1970s. Many of the Haitian black bourgeoisie, they praised the era of Papa Doc because they were able to have jobs in the apparatus as professional managers, etc.
Right, which is why they like the Jovenel Moïse. Martelli regime, because they believe that new neo-Duvalierism was going to bring back the good old days of the black political class. And the mulattoes, because they were displaced by the oligarchs, were fine with that as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's a perfect marriage. You have peace and you were able to implement. There's a destabilization. There's a de-agriculturalization of Haiti that begins under Duvalier and takes us to contemporary times. So with the fall of Baby Doc, which is basically Baby Doc's problem, is the fact that he was just ripe in corruption. It was just in your face. So by the time the Haitian masses rise up and Baby Doc leaves, there's basically a power vacuum then that emerges in Haiti, which Jean-Bertrand Aristide would fulfill in 1990. Now, Aristide's problem is Aristide attempted to undermine both the black professional class as well as the oligarchy. He basically wanted to, all he wanted to do was increase the minimum wage in Haiti, and because the people were being exploited. You have a group coming from the mountains into the capital city who are willing to work for anything under the sun, basically 25 cents an hour, and then the people were being exploited. So for Aristide, coming out of the liberation theology of the Catholic Church, which some will argue parallels Marxist ideology and Marx's call for communism, he felt that, well, there needs to be a modicum of dignity by which the people, the masses of the people, the peasant class, should live. So
I would argue the mistake that Aristide made was actually alienating the black middle class and trying to depend on the mulattoes to back him as being sympathetic to his cause.
Now, well, that's a later phenomenon, because you have to understand when Aristide get into power, you know, because he appealed to the people, and just like under the U.S. occupation where the black Gondon class appealed to the people to salvage their agribusinesses, the same thing took hold. The black professional class gravitated to Aristide in the beginning as well, against the Haitian oligarchy in the beginning. So it's this antagonism.
Right. The Aristide project, which actually I would argue is the Préval project, because Préval was was the brains behind Lavalas. He actually picked Aristide because of his eloquence to be the mouthpiece for the Lavalas project.
Absolutely. We both know
that the Lavalas project was a project by both Haitian black middle class and Haitian light-skinned middle class to create a left flank of politics to Duvalierism in Haiti, because there was no left-based political party after Duvalierism.
And you could not have a left political party in that sense. So which is why, you know, Jean D. St. Paul out of Brooklyn College did a wonderful piece into Aristide's political movement, which is why his only appeal could be through the church or through the philosophy of liberation theology, because there is no anti-communist movement in Haiti.
Anti-capitalist.
Anti-capitalist movement in Haiti. Basically, Duvalier was a staunch anti-communist, so it didn't matter. He basically attacked anyone who had any ideas of communism in their heads. But anyway, so what we find is when Aristide gets into power, there's now an appeal to the masses of the people to try to basically, as we find it all over Latin America, you see the mass suffering that takes place under this dialectical struggle between protectionism, mercantilist capitalism on the one hand, and urban industrial capitalism or free market capitalism on the other. So Aristide attempts to undermine that by, basically appealing to the people, trying to find dignity for the people, and the Americans were not having it.
Aristide is advocating, you know, radical revolution. He's like, the problem are your people in the problem you have are the people who live in the nice houses on the hills, and you know, you can't let them take from you. And his kind of attempt to manifest some type of lumpen proletariat revolution, or ideological revolution, pisses off all the Haitian middle class and the Haitian oligarchs, and they're like, this fool has got to go, because he's going to mess up my peasant restavec, who I haven't paid in three generations, is not going to want to, you know, mop the floor, shine my shoes, and give me some nookie nookie at night like she used to do all the time.
Absolutely. And then remember, coming out of the 1970s, as you all do on this show, there's this counter-revolution. There is this counter-revolution against any form of New Dealism taking place in Latin America or all over the world. And there's a strong push toward neoliberalization to exacerbate what took place in Haiti from the 1950s going up to the 1980s.
And let's make this clear. All of this is happening while all of these presidential administrations are all pawns of the United States up until Aristide.
Absolutely. So now
he becomes a pawn as well, but he didn't start that way.
Absolutely. So there is this need to push this neoliberalization project that is a reaction to not only communism, but also a reaction to any form of New Dealism or state socialism, what have you. So under there's this need for Aristide now to adopt some neoliberal principles, such as the privatization of state apparatuses, the which was under the functionary of the Black Gondon class, which became a professional class under Duvalier. So there is this now this new push under Aristide, pushed by the American neoliberal factions, where you have to privatize state apparatuses such as the electricity.
Aristide is given a coup in 91. And what's his name? Oh my God. I keep forgetting this degenerate's name. Leslie De La Tour, the University of Chicago economist, one of the Chicago boys. For any of you guys who study foreign policy, you know what your University of Chicago foreign economic planning comes up with, structural adjustment plans. Leslie De La Tour tells the Clintons, I can get Aristide to sign on to a structural adjustment package. Clinton's like, yeah, Aristide, you want to come back? Neoliberalize your whole country, sell off your state assets, sell it to private sectors, et cetera, et cetera. And Clinton's basically gets Aristide to sign on to an economic agenda that rapes the Haitian economy and the Haitian state and pauperizes it and further enables the capacity to bring it to the destitute condition it's been in for the last almost 30 years.
And I hope your audience, realize this neoliberal push is not new, as we've been arguing up to this point. Remember, it begins with this transition that takes place in the 1950s, where under the U.S. occupation, continues under Duvalier, and is hyper intensified under beginning in the 1970s as the U.S. is reacting against the New Deal policy. This 50-year counter-revolution that you all like to speak about. So it's a hyper, it's introducing neoliberalism, but it's just simply a continuation of what was happening in Haiti from the U.S. occupation up until 1986.
So again, make this clear, Bill Clinton brings the nails and the wood to crucify the Haitian state with neoliberal policies under Aristide, with structural adjustment plans that sell off the telecom company, sell off the Haitian state cement and concrete company, sell off the digital telephone company, sell off all of the state assets.
Privatize the ports.
All of the assets that basically gave the state revenue was sold off under Clinton, largely to some of his buddies, that pauperized the country. And one of the reasons I'm not a fan of Aristide is that he is the cancer that allows the introduction of the Clinton into the Haitian environment.
So basically, to bring us to contemporary time.
Yeah, quickly, in 2 minutes, get us to today.
2 minutes to bring us into contemporary time. So with the fall of Aristide, Preval would attempt to continue this New Deal type of trying to maintain some of the state apparatuses and appease the Black professional class while also trying to neoliberalize the economy and appease the oligarchy. So Preval was able to do both simultaneously. Now, what would happen post the earthquake, this is where Melanie Klein's bourgeois notion of shock doctrine would take place. America and the oligarchy saw the earthquake as the means to intensify this neoliberal project at the expense of the Black Gondon class. So what you would find is,
at the expense of the Black Gondon class.
At the expense of the Black Gondon class, because once you privatize all state apparatuses, now the Black Gondon class, they're no longer in control over any of the professional managerial positions which they directed in control of these businesses, state-run companies. So now the Gondon class, their only alternative is control over the state by participating in the political process, which now the Haitian oligarchy control through elections, coup d'etats, et cetera. So post the earthquake, when the U.S., Hillary Clinton would have the politicians accept Martelly in a runoff, when he finished third, he should not have been in the runoff. He then gets into power and continues the whole neoliberal project that started, once again, from the U.S. occupation up until contemporary times. So what we find is Jovenel now is in place, is handpicked by Matéri to continue this process. Now, Jovenel runs into some problems. What would happen under the Jovenel administration is that when Trump, the right-wing presidency of Trump, gets into office, there was a deal struck by Préval to continue social programs through the Petrocaribe Fund, which was a Brazilian started by Hugo Chavez, which was a fund put in place where the Haitian state can purchase oil at a certain price and purchase it only, pay 60% up front and use 40% of their of whatever they would use to purchase oil from Venezuela to basically do social programming, build schools, etc. But under this neoliberal project, the Haitian state was forced to use the Petrocaribe deal to do what the Haitian state would call public-private initiatives, where they would take the Petrocaribe funds to give to private industry to do their social programming. And part of this social programming, the Haitian state is so cynical, was used to purchase the ports for the first time under this neoliberal project. Now, in all of Haiti's history, the Haitian state has always been able to control the ports. This is how the Haitian state ascertained much of its revenue. Under Matéri and this hyper-intensified neoliberal project, the oligarchy was able, Biggio, Boulos, Appel, they were able to control now the ports through what the state called public-private initiatives, where the Haitian state would put up the funds for private interests to take over the electricity company, to take over the ports, to take over taxes. So now the Haitian state is left with no means of ascertaining revenue, on top of the right-wing administration of Trump placing an embargo on Venezuela, where they were using the Petrocaribe fund to hyper-intensify this whole neoliberal project. So now what Jovenel did was he began to attack the Haitian oligarchy. He began to claim that they were not paying their share of taxes. They were taking money from the Haitian state and not doing what they claimed they were doing. And he attacked Reginald Boulos. He put out arrest warrants on some of the Haitian oligarchy. And it brings us to now. And I will end this by saying this, and from my perspective, is a coup d'etat that took place. And it's either the Haitian oligarchy got the okay from the American state, because they don't do anything without the okay of Washington. So for me, this is a coup d'etat that took place because Jovenel had no choice but to attack the Haitian bourgeoisie to continue his social programming for the masses. He had lost control over the country by that time. So,
but you agree that the PSTK agenda was bogus anyway, because it was fundamentally neoliberal. Do you think it was actually going to change things for the better?
No, absolutely not. It's a continuation of the project that began during the American occupation.
People like Lamont and all these other, you know, neoliberal degenerates who always just want to suck blood out of the country, who are a lot of Haitian middle class gun door types who, you know, cheerlead, like people in my family who love Martelli, don't realize that these degenerates just want to replicate the same class hierarchy, but get their own internal fat back and biscuits by running businesses with foreign actors to keep the peasants poor while the black middle class sucks the blood out of them and still has their positions of security. Am I right or wrong?
Absolutely, brother. And the sad thing is, when you privatize these state apparatuses, and the reason why I say it's a coup d'etat,
it would have been a disaster for them anyway, because there's no more state apparatuses for the black middle class to work in to have jobs anymore.
But this is why I say it's a coup d'etat, Pascal, is because of the fact that with this the intent now for the black professional managerial class now is to obtain employment from the Haitian oligarchy.
That's all the mulattoes and the blacks, the black elite can do now.
Absolutely. For the Haitian oligarchy. Absolutely. And this is why, for me, the way I see what's going on contemporarily, it has to be a coup d'etat with elements from the black professional managerial class and elements of the Haitian oligarchy saying, hey, we're losing control because what was happening in Haiti because Jovenel was attacking the oligarchy, the gangs that were sponsored by the oligarchy were preventing trade taking place in Haiti. There was gang violence. They had blockaded some of the roads leading from the north to the south. So whereas, some left-wing and journalists want to argue that the gangs represent a revolution of the lumpen proletariat. I'm not ready to make that analysis yet, but
I think there is being hired by both sides, the by Jovenel as well as the oligarchy, to bang it out against each other.
Yes, to undermine the country, because right.
The only people that are dying are the peasants who are trying to protest.
And then with this assassination, as the latest New York Times report, with this assassination. Now I hear that the Haitian state has appealed to the Americans to send forces to Haiti to help them control the violence and investigate the assassination. And this is what the oligarchy wanted, because you need a modicum of some stability in order to have any sort of economic
interaction. And I think also I saw somewhere I posted, allegedly the Haitian Senate has name the new interim president. I don't know if that's bogus. I doubt the U.S.
Yeah, that was the rumor.
I doubt the U.S. government is going to recognize that.
Joseph Lambert.
I think that what's happened is that the U.S. State Department and the oligarchs are going to try to find a replacement president with a sham election who will work with the oligarchs
absolutely. The
State Department and fulfill this neoliberal agenda.
Yes, they need a dark-skinned politique de double. They need a little dark-skinned peasant in control. All you got to do is keep your mouth shut and do what we say.
And on that note, I think it might be question time. We went originally we was going to go 45 minutes. We're 55 minutes in.
Sorry about that.
Oh, don't be. I mean, you guys were on a roll. I can't interrupt a roll like that. I do want to get to this super chat question from Sean Moon. Does this was asked probably 15 minutes ago. Can you guys see the question?
Does this
constitute what could be called a comprador class? Is there a parallel with the condition of the American working class and those who claim to advocate for them while actually serving them up for hyper exploitation?
Would you call a Gondon class a comprador class?
I would call both the oligarchy as well as the Gondon class a comprador bourgeoisie.
Yeah, they're all comprador bourgeoisie. Yes, they all work at the behest of the imperialists.
Absolutely.
Anybody else have any questions? It's question time, guys. We only got a few minutes. Don't get questions soon.
There's no after hours tonight, guys.
I have a 2-year-old behind me that is not messing around.
What's up with the Dominican Republic? That's a long story, man.
That's a long story. And the interesting thing, many of the oligarchy, what they did with the political unrest that would impact Haiti, many of them moved their tourism and their assembly factories into the DR. So many of the, when you go to Punta Cana and many of these resorts, you're basically, it's the Haitian oligarchy in control of some of these resources.
By the way, I'm not a fan of C.L. James or Black Jacobins because he totally mischaracterizes the importance of Dessalines and tries to frame him as some kind of monster when he's actually the hero of the Haitian Revolution. And he, like many Black middle-class folks, has a love affair with Toussaint Louverture, who was not the hero of the Haitian Revolution. That's why I'm not a fan of the Black Jacobins.
I love Dessalines as the father of my country, but I'm not a real fan of Dessalines. My people are Makaya and Sans Souci, the Africans who would fight in the revolution. Because if it wasn't for the Africans, Haiti would have fell to the French. So, because the Africans continued to fight when Christophe Dessalines capitulated to the French side.
That's true, they did.
This is a great question. What is your source of Napoleon wanted to invade the U.S.?
Oh, all you have to read is, what's that book? The Half Has Never Been Told by Edward Baptiste. The Half Has Never Been Told, Edward Baptiste.
This is probably the greatest question that we've been asked today. This is by a show contributor, Jean Bajon. Did Pascal enjoy scaring white people today on Majority
Report? I don't know why they would have been scared.
They were totally terrified. It was beautiful. My child is too
Glandon. Spell Glandon for
me. Grandon.
Grandon. Glandon. Glandon is bad. French for big. The Glandon, like the Don Dada.
Someone said that Pascal scared all the MSNBC liberals.
And I did a wonderful thing today.
Exactly. I'll never say you sold out. Me, on the other hand, totally kidding.
Yeah, they were taken aback by Pascal's passion.
I don't know if they knew what they were getting. Like, oh, this guy knows about Haiti. He's got a Haitian name and everything. Okay, you don't know what you signed up for.
Jim Churi says, does Jim Churi have a super chat? She says, so.
Wait, don't skip my suit. I don't see it. Oh, no. Keep talking, guys, for a couple minutes. I'm going to look for this person's super chat because I don't see it. Pascal, keep talking. Be entertaining.
Oh, be entertaining.
Dance.
What about the Commodore class in the USA? Those who have collaborated with the 50-year counter-revolution. There's lots of them.
There's a lot. That's a no-brainer. That's a
whole other conversation.
That's a no-brainer. And but you know what, Pascal? What's interesting is there's been several assassination attempts on Aristide's life, for example. But they feared, as Clinton, if you read the WikiLeaks report, they feared that they would turn Aristide into a martyr, which is why they never assassinated. And they feared that they would not be able to control the Haitian masses. Because even under Martelly, there was an attempt to bring Aristide to justice. In the crowd, the Haitian masses were in an uproar. They went in front of his house and they said, hey, we will burn Haiti to the ground. And what's interesting, this struggle between the Haitian oligarchy and the emerging black professional class is at the expense of the Haitian state, because both groups are willing to destroy the Haitian state so that their interests, they can fulfill their interests. So even this false sense of black nationalism that you see among the black professional class, the black political class in Haiti, it's superficial. It's a cursory form of nationalism. They don't care. So long as their interest is manifested, they don't care.
Absolutely. The great information books, I say From Dessalines to Duvalier by John Nichols.
Excellent.
Excellent book. From
Haiti, the Aftershock of History is in that. It gives you a history of Haiti up to the contemporary time. That's next.
Haiti, the Aftershocks of History. That's by who?
Laurent Dubois.
Laurent Dubois. That's another good book.
Yes. That's an excellent source. The Making of History is also a wonderful one as well. What else I would recommend? I would recommend James D. St. Paul. His title slips my mind for now, but his book is pretty good too. He gives in your boy, Sergi Saint-Joseph. He has an excellent book on Aristide's liberation theology.
I'm not interested in that.
Wow.
No, I'm interested in Sergi Saint-Joseph. I'm just not interested in Aristide.
I still want to do a James Cone-esque episode. I actually I enjoyed The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And I went.
Sergi Saint-Joseph is a great scholar. I think he's just too much affection for Aristide. I'm not an Aristide apologist.
Well, you know, he's a pastor as well, so you know the brother got his theology supersedes his class analysis.
Yeah.
As somebody wanted to know, am I single? No, I'm married.
Damn.
I think we can wrap it up, gentlemen.
I'm good.
Thank you guys so much for doing this. Thank you, Paul, for doing this kind of last minute.
No problem. No problem, gentlemen.
Paul's going back into his writing cocoon, so you might not see him on media for a while, but he definitely will spit out some books. How many do you have? You said 20?
Yes, yes, yes.
20 books.
You get all your books on Amazon?
Oh, every single one. Don't buy my books. Just read the journal articles on, go to my academic page and read all my journal articles.
Do you have a link to all the academic works?
It should be on the...
academicu.edu, whatever that is. Academic or ResearchGate as well.
Yeah, that's
or where Google my name.
That's where I read the essay, and we had a link to that on the last show. So if you guys watched the last show, which was Tuesday, and subscribe to the YouTube channel, and they still
be Saturday's show is going to be Daruba Bin Wahab. What is the revolutionary capacity of Black America? Former member of the Black Liberation Army and the Black Panther Party.
So if you weren't frightened by Pascal on the Majority Report, I'm so looking forward to Saturday.
Pascal keeps it real, brother. I enjoy you guys. Thank you for the show that you all do. I watch it all the time. So
hopefully a lot of people have been watching it too, as well. Hopefully more.
Yeah, you guys have me blowing up on Twitter. I have to say no to a lot of interviews. That's into my research time.
People are yelling at me because I'm not putting the link. So I'm putting the link right now in the chat to Paul McComb on ResearchGate right now so you guys can see it. Somebody said, don't be lazy, do it. It's like, you know what I'm doing back here? You know how much?
I will be on All Common Ground tomorrow night with Janice Peak Graham, who is in the chat.
So Pascal is doing the whole circuit. Can we talk about your other show appearance that you're going to do next week? Or no, not yet?
Not yet. Not ready to disclose that.
Okay. But he's doing the rounds, everybody. And I'm very, very happy. I spoke with Doug Lane today. I gave him the episode. So Zero Books is going to be airing the episode next week of the Critical Race Theory episode you were on, Paul.
Oh, okay.
And Doug goes, man, we need to capitalize on Pascal and have him finish this book.
Well, here we go. Marx is talking about capitalizing on people's labor. Listen to that.
Right? Hey, capitalizing on all this heat. It's hot. All right, you guys, thank you so much. And let's go. I got to go watch this badass kid. Peace.
A good night, gentlemen.
All right, brother. Peace.